Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Kostura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of May 11th, 2026. All right, so this is going to be kind of a special rundown, but Tom, you did a lot of the work this week, so I'll let you kind of introduce everything, and then we'll just go from there. So what do you got for us first?
Yeah, sounds good. So the first couple articles we're going to talk about are going to point in the current world we live in of supply chain attack, and that little bubble there, if we're going to call it a little bubble. So the first one's from Hacker News, and it is titled Mini Shai-Hulud Worm Compromises TanStack, Mistral AI, Guardrails AI, and More Packages. So just kind of a general summary here to kick it into gear for this one, Scott. So researchers uncovered a rapidly spreading software supply chain worm dubbed Mini Shai-Hulud that compromised major NPM and PyPI ecosystems, including TanStack, Mistral AI, OpenSearch, UiPath, and Guardrails AI packages. The campaign has been attributed to Team PCP and represents really that escalation of earlier Shai-Hulud activity, evolving from credential theft into a highly automated self-propagating CI/CD compromise worm, basically. Instead of stealing developer passwords directly, the attackers abused GitHub Actions OIDC trust relationships and the release workflows alongside of them, allowing for malicious packages to be published through legitimate pipelines with valid signatures. The campaign demonstrates, and it really shows that shift in supply chain risk, something that's just been continuous and scaling almost for about 12 months now in the same direction. Attackers are now targeting the software release processes itself, turning trusted packages, trusted package ecosystems and CI systems into really automated malware distribution infrastructure. I felt good putting that one together. So, the article here, you know, the reason I layered in on this one, there's been a lot of reports around this specific one. This one's, I guess, probably the more recent one, or it is the more recent one, only a few days old. And a lot of places have reported on this, Akito, Endor Labs, Socket, Step Security, and so on. This one kind of brings it all together just to kind of give the overview. So Scott, when you went through and walked through this article, what were some of the first things you pulled out, man? What were the things you noticed the most?
I mean, digging into especially the Team PCP stuff previously and looking at a lot of the activities that were being achieved or done, I feel like with the supply chain stuff, when we first started seeing some supply chain stuff, there was some like, you know, theft of things or some like more like basic actions. So sometimes it was maybe not that much telemetry to run off of. But I feel like these supply chain attacks, because they're becoming a common vector and there's like a lot more to potentially gain from them, actors have been kind of building in more capabilities. And I think that's kind of a good thing from a defender's perspective, because that means there's more opportunities to identify when something like this has occurred. So like when looking at the Team PCP stuff with the Python library, then a lot of actions where, just like typical threat actors, when they want to like understand the environment, they use a lot of lull bin reconnaissance type activity, but it's all driven from Python, which if you would think, depending on where you're deploying these types of packages, wouldn't be normal to potentially see that activity just from that standpoint. And then you also look at like the NPM supply chain approach. Well, now you have Node EXE typically executing things that, you know, replicate that same behavior. So like for me, it was almost like, all right, well, maybe we just need to, you know, change our mindset from what we're used to, like when command prompt or PowerShell or bash or whatever kicks certain things off. Maybe we just kind of take a step back and say, well, what's really parenting all of this? And look for those same behaviors we typically look for in a lot of this stuff. Now, I guarantee it's not going to catch like everything. But it seems like as the attacks mature, there's that greater opportunity. So, you know, looking at the different things they focus on, I do like the, you know, when you, a developer evokes the token, they have like the remove of like their home directory and stuff like that. Which isn't going to be a good indication, because you'll know something happened at that point, because that's why you're removing certain tokens and keys. But I think that's a good way to make sure that you're monitoring where you have these DevOps, where you have potentially production stuff that uses different Python packages, NPM packages, and things like that. Make sure you have the same kind of visibility and telemetry you would when you're protecting just your normal environment. Because I think there's a lot of, maybe you can even, you know, tune it up a little more because you expect less noise because it should be more static potentially, right? So that's kind of where my head went with a lot of these now that I've been seeing so many of these and they've been growing. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does. This is going to be, I mean, we're already almost halfway through the year, right? And we've been talking about it ad nauseum, and it's scaling, right? There's a lot of things that are growing. You see things like Team PCP, they're evolving. I actually spent some time this week, Scott, trying to see if it was, you know, is anybody talking about, because, you know, there's a lot of references to Shai-Alud, and a lot of stuff in the code is talking about, indicators or language towards references to the Doom universe, right? And I was curious. I'm like, you know, we had the original Shai-Alud, you know, that worm was pretty, it was self-propagating early on. This is back in September of last year. And I was wondering if it was tied to Team PCP, and I kind of settled in on a little bit of, like, you know, I went into a bit of attribution mode for I don't know what reason. And it's interesting because it seems like they don't specifically connect, even though there is that kind of like language tie-in or the labels or title tie-in. It seems like the self-propagating worm was really developed, and it seems like Team PCP has kind of been evolving as it's been doing things since it's kind of like been labeled on the scene. So there's almost like this little invisible wall of separation. But still, what's interesting with this is that evolution is very notable. And the one thing that you talked about with Node, that's been a big stickler for me for the supply chain stuff, because you're seeing it used in almost every scenario.
Yeah.
More so is it seems like since that methodology has kind of really come on, really back to the original Shai-Alud incident last year, leveraging Node to deploy your payloads to execute what you're trying to do on your compromised system, or what they're trying to do on compromised systems, really has taken flight. So leveraging Node to execute this stuff has been seen across other vectors, right? We've seen it attributed in attacks with APT groups. We've seen stuff alongside of ransomware. We're also seeing the stuff with the supply chain attacks. It's an adopted behavior that's happening. And what's great about that is that the telemetry for that exists. So basic stuff like we do as hunters, where we look for those anomalies, like, right, like the surface level stuff that we should always care about, right? Parent-child process relationships. If you're watching Node launching other child processes, script interpreters, things like that, this is anomalous. You should be tracking this. This is in your telemetry that's already existing, almost certainly. A lot of the leveraging of Node helps these payloads and these attacks kind of fly under the radar with like EDR and others and security tooling, because they're not really paying attention to it. And furthermore, something that happened alongside this one, and we've seen it a couple times in spot incidences, including all the way back to the original Shai-Alud one, where the adversary was leveraging Node to then pull down Bun runtime and then execute payloads through Bun, creating those layers of kind of not obfuscation, but those layers of hiding, right? Being able to execute with distance. Thank you. So that's something else to watch for and track for too. You can easily, that, you know, that's something I think as hunters right now, if you're talking supply chain attack, consider that behavior is like numero uno for something that you can really gain traction on. That's just my take, because you're just seeing it. You're seeing the trend over and over again for these kinds of behaviors, leveraging of Node. There's stuff there that you can see, even though a lot of the activity that happens inside of those post-install and pre-install hooks, which is why Node and Bun are being leveraged, tends to be invisible. So you tend to not be able to see some of the stuff that's happening. You can see the processes that are executing in weird ways, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, the supply chain stuff has been fantastic. I also, you know how we are when we see certain like attacks and stuff, and there's things that kind of make us like smile almost sarcastically. The dead man switch in this one of like, if you tried to remove it, it just wiped you, was kind of brutal, right? Like it was, you know what I mean? I was like, well, and I chuckled a little bit sarcastically about that one.
Yeah, and it's funny because that means like the attackers, assuming that, okay, if they find this, this is what they'll do. So this is what I'll do to them. Like they're already like thinking through all that. So it's kind of funny.
Well, let's jump into the next supply chain piece. So this one was reported within the past week directly from Checkmarks. It was a Checkmarks supply chain security incident. They disclosed a major software supply chain compromise affecting portions of its open source ecosystem, including Kix GitHub Actions, OpenVSX plugins, and other related CI/CD artifacts. The incident appears connected to, again, broader Team PCP supply chain campaigns, which previously kind of targeted some of those Trivi GitHub Actions. And, you know, at this point, we know a lot of what Team PCP has done in all those CI/CD ecosystems and their downstream, the downstream infrastructure, and leveraging stolen credentials, poisoned release tags, and so on. So the attackers injected credential stealing malware into trusted developer tooling and release workflows, creating a scenario where those legitimate CI/CD pipelines executed attacker-controlled code unknowingly. The compromise, again, reinforces that growing trend. Supply chain attacks are here, aggressively, almost nauseatingly. This one, it just kind of stacks, right, Scott? So there wasn't anything necessarily net new or overwhelmingly novel about the kind of targets and the go after, but you are seeing a lot of stuff that I think from a hunter's perspective that you see echoed out. So like one of the things that I've pulled here is like, even though the supply chain attack stuff is new, some of it's hard to see or understand, or, you know, really figure out as you're going through this process, and it has big impact. There's still a lot of really basic things that happen. Again, watching those parent-child processes for the, you know, NPM or for Node and Bun and so on. Also, one of the other things you see here is kind of those curl wget type executions where they're going out pulling payloads in certain ways down the payload chain. So, you know, again, it's just more echo into that supply chain piece. But did you pull anything specific out of this one, Scott?
For me, when I was looking at this, my favorite thing was, I feel like this is like the perfect example of how these things should be reported and the information shared. It's just like a glowing example, just because I like how they basically summarize the whole incident at like a high level, but like a timeline there. And then the overall, like what they've done, so they can, you know, either attribute what's going on or also say, you know, is the problem resolved? But they also break down the different phases of the incident as they were kind of uncovering it as far as impact, and go in detail as far as like what really happened, what were the key findings, what were the affected artifacts, which is really important because one of the tough things is if you feel like you're using this product or you're pulling down these libraries or whatever it is, your first question is like, how do we know if we're actually affected, right? And they don't just give like, if you're using this version number, right, necessarily. They give you the version number. They give you the time frame in which they know that things were impacted so that you can potentially see when was the last time the package you pulled down was like written to disk. So maybe you can compare timestamps even. And so they go through that. And they also talk about the actions they took on their end to remediate, which I think is also a really good example because it shows, you know, how responsible they're trying to be. But as a security practitioner, it gives you an opportunity to basically say, like, did they cover their bases correctly? And if you feel like they missed something, then it kind of gives you, okay, if they missed this, then do we need to like, have more oversight on something? Or is there something they missed that we may be able to do on our end to validate or whatever, right? So I think those, like the openness and transparency of this was like just perfect and spot on. It had all the right details. And I don't think you typically see this type of write-up for people to get hit with stuff. And I think with supply chain is really important because it's not like, especially when it's like, we're talking about like open markets and open source and packages that way, like it's not like someone bought it, so like, you know, they don't have to disclose to the world because only have a finite group of customers. Anyone can use it, right? So like having this open transparency for stuff like this is really important as well. So that was like my biggest key takeaway is the things they're looking at, which is also good because if you are someone that does manage libraries, repos, tools, whatever, you can learn from this too so that you're not the next victim, right? Like, what are the actions they took? What are the things they hardened? How did they, you know, go through their response on all of that as well? So I just feel like it's just a really good find for this is an ongoing problem, but here's some things you could do and here's something, and this is how it should be done, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you echoed that because that was going to be like the back end takeaway I had with this one. And I love that they keep updating it. I like that you're seeing the routine process of this, they're reporting it. It's clean. It builds confidence. It lets you know that, hey, we're in this together. We're attacking this together. You know, it doesn't, it's rough if, especially if it's something that a vendor or a supplier that you're heavily relying on where it goes super black box once they're in that place. And
right,
to a degree you understand it, but to the other side, it's like, well, we all are in this together, right? So we have to get through it together. So be transparent, help out, take feedback from the community, work together kind of thing. I love this just for that reason alone too, Scott.
Yeah. Cause supply chain is like an everyone problem, right? Yeah. So even if you're like at the root of it, it doesn't mean that like, oh, like just worry about me. It's like, it is we're in this together because a lot of supply chain attacks, let's be honest, it's not really, it's found out by someone who's like victim of after the fact. And then it's back to the root, right? So it's like for a company to want to black box their response and not really talk about it, it's like, yeah, but you probably didn't find it. So it's like, I don't feel like you could really take that stance, you know?
But yeah. Oh yeah. I wonder ultimately, you know, kind of the back end of talking about the supply chain stuff for today's show, I wonder ultimately what a real fix is going to be. Like, do you think that this is going to just kind of be a continuous run on that? It's just the Wild West right now. Is this going to expedite some kind of a new process, a new kind of standing way that we're going to go about this that we're just not doing now, a new tool or new something that pops up to help us really defend against this, or is this just going to be whack-a-mole? What do you think?
I think it's funny because it's just like, was it DNSSEC, right? Like, we had ways to secure DNS, but for it to really work, everybody has to basically onboard it and be involved. It can't just be like, oh, we do it here, not over here kind of solution, right? And for like code and everything else, like we have ways to do like signed code, ways to do like versioning control, ways to do proper authentication so that potentially you can put more controls on how someone authenticates to even update code, stuff like that. Like, it all exists. It's just not all being utilized. So I feel like it's one of those things where this problem is just kind of crept up because we haven't been utilizing what we already had in place to utilize to begin with. So if we start adopting the things that we created, I feel like it would help at least handle. I mean, like, for instance, how many EDR tools will, when they look at any kind of executable, will tell you if it's signed or not? I mean, they almost all do, but do you use that as a true trigger? Not really, because there's a lot of code that's just not signed. So it's like, well, we can't break things, right? So it's crazy that we have telemetry even around this because we know it would be a good solution. But yeah, like, there's just processes and technology that already exists. It's just a matter of getting people. I mean, you know, it's inconvenient and it's, you know, since these things are created a long time ago, it's not like there's no easy button, because back when it was created, there was no easy button. But I just feel like it's funny that sometimes we feel like we have to create a new tool or a new approach when it's like, I mean, we've had things in a while that we've never adopted. Let's just try those first, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like, you know, you see a lot of the chatter about these. You see folks talking about the supply chain stuff. And the biggest thing comes down to, like, you know, what would be a standard way to secure this stuff from the repository side of the house, from the developer side of the house. I mean, I think there's,
There's obviously already ways, and it's not like it's something that needs a new technology for, but it's almost like we don't have, it feels like the Wild West, and how this stuff happens and what's going to continue to happen. And I can't help but, from my, at least my own opinion and my perspective, Scott, I don't see this stopping or slowing down. I see this being the new ransomware, you know, like the new big thing where it's like, this is going to happen constantly. And the breadth of it's an obvious target. The impact that you can have, the success rate you can have as an adversary if you get into certain places in this space is so big.
Right.
I feel like a new tool that maybe could be beneficial, that could be kind of like in the loop, is if you're going to commit new code, AI is a great example where, why don't you have the AI write the summary of the code change, where it could be like, all right, do the diff from, here's the code, this is what I changed, like, here's the new code, report out what you see. And then there will be at least something someone can review, and it'll be like, oh, it opens up new connections to here, it downloads this and executes this, or it's very highly obfuscated. Like, there's some key things that might just be triggers that way. And then it really, someone would have to be really creative on how to hide code in code. But the more it hides it, I think the more obvious it is too, right? So it's like, maybe there's things like that now with some new technology, but like, who's
going to feel like it can be done, right? Some kind of a comparable, or even like put it in some, I don't know. I think there's workflows, right? Like your developer, certain machines, like if you're pulling down that new novel packages or something like that, you go through a different process where it sits in some kind of a box that can flag it before it's released into something, right? Like have, not necessarily going to track everything, but have some kind of a system almost like a sandbox, but not entirely automated. So it doesn't, give away those signatures to be evaded, right? But yeah, AI comparison thing is great. Like it just, check it out. Make sure your code checks. And maybe that's it. Maybe we're just not checking these things. But I have to assume we are at some point, because people are identifying it. And we're identifying them pretty fast, which is also kind of a scary thing, that the breadth of the impact of this happens so quick too. That's why the space is just, it's ripe for intrusion.
Yeah, and we're also more aware of it. So, who knows how long at some level this was going on before, but now it's spotlighted. So
yeah. Yep. All right. Well, let's move away from supply chain for a little bit. Let's talk a little more about AI. So this one, I found this interesting. I'm torn on where my thoughts fully lie, but I kind of want to see where you're at first. So article from Google Threat Intelligence, adversaries leverage AI for vulnerability exploitation, augmented operations, and initial access. So the Google Threat Intelligence Group reported that adversaries are now actively leveraging AI models for vulnerability discovery, exploit generation, operational scaling, and initial access workflows. Moving that AI abuse a lot farther from theory and a lot closer to active operations. So Google identified that what it believes is the first observed AI-assisted zero-day exploit, intended for mass exploitation, signaling a major shift in that offensive cyber capability acceleration. Nation state and criminal actors linked to the PRC, DPRK, and Russia were observed experimenting with AI for exploit development, refining malware, creating more of that automation in their ops, and helping them scale faster into larger ops. The report emphasizes that AI is not replacing operators, but acting as that force multiplier. I think this is something me and you both talked about, and I'm not going to say we're Nostradamuses, if that's the right way to say that or anything. We didn't, it's not really a prediction thing, but it just seems obvious, right? Like if any analysis, like, hey, that's where we're headed. But yeah, adversaries are using it as a force multiplier based on Google's interpretation in this report, really improving that speed, scale, sophistication, and all the nasty things that are required to have effective offensive operations. They also highlighted that the attack surface now includes AI infrastructure itself, including the model gateways, the AI plugins, dependency chains, and even inference environments. So there's kind of like a depth of thought in this article, I thought. I have some thoughts, but I'm curious what you think first, Scott.
Yeah, so one, I think it's a great write-up on all the different ways AI is being leveraged. And I think they're kind of spot on some things, but I think there are some talking points that need to be grounded a little bit, right? So from like the vulnerability discovery, I think this is great. Like, I know there's been the whole freak out of like, oh my gosh, AI is uncovering all these unknown zero days and all this whatever. Well, to be completely honest, if you give someone source code and they have the knowledge, they can find the same zero days, right? It comes back to, let's not have source code exposed so that AI can't read it, right? So how do you protect your source code? Now, bigger problem is we use a lot of open source code and things. So inherently, source code is out there and available for AI to like look for that coding practice kind of stuff. But it's not like a novel thing that it can find something that we can't given source code. Like that's you know, one of those things. And, you know, example or a tangent to that is, you know, talking to someone who actually developed exploits, they were telling about the process of like, well, you know, like how do you determine where an exploit is, or how do you find something? And, you know, they use the example of, you know, we know the protocols that are used, like HTTP, HTTPS, right? And if you go to the RPC, it's RCP, RPC, whatever the requests, whatever the standard, right, that gets written. In those standards, they basically describe what it does, what are all the data points and fields, the interactions, everything associated with that protocol. And in some places, they just have like, it must do this, right? And in other places, it's like optional or suggested, right? And the problem is the protocols that are put out there as guidelines for how people like implement it, it's still built by developers. And those developers, they usually are pretty good to say if it must do something, trying to code that right so it follows the protocol to that T. But the suggested or optional stuff is kind of up to the developer, right? And depending on how they do those things, creates gaps or problems where maybe the implementation of, say, HTTP or something, an attacker might be able to test those optional data points or, you know, parts of the protocol and find a bug. And so I feel like that's similar to, you know, AI looking at source code, right? Like, how did the developer implement something? As a normal person who's looking for exploits or writing exploits is doing the same process. So not novel, just speed, right? You got speed, you got something that it can look at very complex mass amounts of things, less more efficiently. So I'm not like blown away so much by that. And for exploit generation, it's just a speed component because it's still kind of being done in the similar, like, I guess, mindset or process. So there's that. The other thing that really stood out to me was, you know, there's a lot of these services that let you sign up for AI. It's not with the actual AI provider. So they kind of like are a broker. And then you kind of have like this proxy at which you're able to leverage these AI models to these big vendors, but it's not tied to like a person or an account that's like the typical account. Anytime there's going to be services like this, actors are going to take more and more advantage of stuff. I mean, look at the proxies or the virtual private networks, the VPNs or the VPCs for like standing up, you know, hosted environments that you can use for C2 and things that makes things more distant from the actual adversary. Now they have a front to work from. So I feel like that also makes it very easy to do some of those things. Now I did find when they talked about like the autonomous malware operations, and they described like the prompt spy they use on the Android device and how like if you tried to uninstall, it would detect that and put a button in front of the uninstall button so that it intercepts your touches so that you couldn't uninstall. I think that's interesting. They call that that's like a big AI thing. But I mean, if it does that every time, is it really an AI thing or a feature that someone requested and the AI built? You know what I mean? Like, I think like if AI is really this like all autonomous, it can do all these things, it's not going to do the same thing every time, right? It's going to deal with situations potentially differently. If it's the same time, it's just like code. So that kind of made me step back a little bit and say, yes, I'm sure maybe AI helps suggest what solution to those problems the attacker wants to address, or maybe the attacker knows what they want to do, but they don't know how to do it. AI helps with that as far as, you know, writing some of the malware stuff. I mean, there's those things. So once again, I still feel like AI is a huge tool. And I like this article because it really breaks down all the different ways it can be leveraged. But the scare of it all doesn't really strike me as, you know, whatever, you know, like we got to protect source code. We got to know what we're running. We got to look for the standard telemetry because, you know, let's be honest, an attacker usually doesn't just attack and not communicate. So there's kind of be stuff that goes on, unless it's like, you know, your Stuxnet style attack, but that's not an attack for everybody. That's so targeted that, you know, when you get hit with something like that, you kind of just lose, but that's not something you can dwell on. So yeah, right. I don't know. It's a really, really good article to talk about and show examples of some of these things. And I do like, I mean, they started off where I think they were even using AI to find the zero day they're able to potentially stop, right? Mm-hmm. Which just shows that, you know, we all got to realize what tools are there and we've all got to use them responsibly and use them successfully. So like the domain that's like, we got to stay away from AI, they're the ones that are going to get hurt the most, right? Businesses were like that when AI first emerged. But we got to just understand the risks like we do with any new technology. And we just got to have strategies and conversations and processes around those.
Yeah. And, you know, really, I love the article because I like talking about the details of AI versus...
They have good examples.
Yeah, but more so of like the overall theory of the whole thing versus trying to find this one-off, oh my God moment, even though there's some sprinkling of flavor in this about that. The way that we look at AI, and you said it, you touched on it, the article does, AI is a force multiplier right now. That's really what it is.
Mm.
As you pointed out, there's the vulnerability finding. It's not about that it can do it, but like that shouldn't surprise anybody,
right?
That you can create code to look for vulnerabilities. There are already tools that can go into an environment and find vulnerabilities in that environment based off known database type stuff. So why wouldn't we be able to scale to find new stuff, right? Again, if you have access to the code and you have the knowledge, you can find it. Any human could too. It's not really new. It's just the thing that people should, I think, should be talked about more is not that it's a surprise that this has happened in a wild shock, big headline thing. It should be more about already talking about how do we prepare for the speed at which it will, because that's the caveat. That's the thing that people should be preparing for, in my opinion, is the speed at which things like this will occur, because you have a system that doesn't have limitations of humans, right? It's not, there's not a time breakdown. There's not a, the AI doesn't have to sleep for X amount of hours or still right, have to go eat food. Right. You know, it's just exponentially more time on that task, which is going to produce a lot more results and it's going to produce them a lot faster. So when we think about that, in my mind, I always fall back to this thing where I'm like, okay, being worried about this you should remove that from your bucket if you can. Consider preparing for it. Think about how you would handle it if that world was suddenly thrust upon you and your environment was being rapid. You know, there was a bunch of vulnerabilities happen, even if it wasn't in your environment. Let's say that suddenly you have 5 vulnerabilities reported a day and now we're up to 60, right? Do we stop and, you know, we're going to shut everything down? The thing comes down to, in my mind, is go back to the basics. Do the basics, because we always run into these problems where that 1% chance of something happening to us keeps us up at night. I know I was guilty of that earlier in my career, for sure. I'm always thinking about those novel things that are going to be the one thing that sparks this big fallout, you know, all the big scary malware from the highly backed APT group that is so novel that no one's seen it before. And how am I going to be able to detect that? Like a lot of people find their way into that place. A lot of people don't sleep all night because of the headlines talking about those kinds of things. But if you do the basics, if you track the basic stuff, there are finite ways to go after systems. If you understand your environment,
You track all the basic stuff that are real key indicators that are non-dodgeable telemetry-wise. You're hunting, detecting, aware, you know, digging through the environment, putting in all the blockades so you understand what's what. If you just do that, 95% of the worry goes away for this. Like, it really does. So you can sleep well on that 95% confidence. And then when you're awake, you can battle the 5%, right? Like, if you take that approach, I think we're going to be in good place here. The other thing that
I kind of look at too is a lot of people, and I don't know that we've talked about this yet, Scott, but AI is, because the other side is happening, right? We're spinning up agents left and right. We're building models left and right. People are building custom stuff. There's a lot of AI stuff that's happening even on the defender side, which creates, and I thought there was like points that at least brought up this thought inside of this article where we have to consider that attack vector, I think. And I hope people, as we're spinning these things up, are stopping and thinking about, okay, I'm building these models, I'm building this AI agent. Like, I hope someone's considering in that developer pipeline if it's happening, because I know we're trying to keep pace at everything that's changing so fast now. How are you identifying intrusions into that, right? Say you stand up some random model, random agent inside of your environment. Are you watching to see what happens or impacts or affects that agent? Are you tracking anything that goes in and out of that tooling in any way? Are you looking at any of the any adjustments to the workflows, anything like that? Are you looking at how tokens are being leveraged, how much is being used? Like, is there any type of telemetry or behavior that you're considering on your models? I don't know the answers to this because I haven't spent a lot of time digging in on it from a lab perspective. This is all theory, but I hope people are doing that. You get what I mean, Scott?
Yeah.
I mean,
I think this points out that it's going to be an attack surface. Like, it already is, but are we paying attention enough to it? Are we just trying to keep pace with the next great thing, or trying to rapid fire this development of this stuff, you know?
Well, like the last two points I wanted to make, and one, like, for instance, I was gonna bring up one of the examples they brought up, which I thought was aligned with what I was saying earlier, where they were able to see where a zero-day vulnerability was implemented in a Python script that bypassed two-factor authentication. Like, you know, we've been preaching two-factor forever, right? Like, we need that two-factor, at least just the one key thing. We know we can get bypassed sometimes, but it's like really strong security. But the two-factor is on a popular open source web-based administration tool. Like, you know, open source, I mean, like, it's not surprising, right? The code's out there. These are the types of things that we have to be aware of. But the thing is, I think the scary part about AI isn't that someone's using a tool to help them attack. It's when someone can sit there and say, hey, they can use an AI and say, go attack said company, extract all their data and do whatever. And then they sit back and they don't touch anything, right? I think that's the fear some people have in their head when they talk about AI attacks, is like the AI is just going to take over and do things, almost like Skynet, right? This whole like automated AI autonomous system that you can just attack. But from a person who's looked at data long enough, I feel like that would also spike on the radar, right? Like, there is some machine speed thing trying to figure out how to break in and attack. Wouldn't that be like a surge of activity, unless you just had like an open door somewhere that was just easy to find anyways, which then a human would do the same thing. So I feel like,
yeah,
just looking at time-based type of activity, and then it's like, okay, so that, because that's the scary thing. Things happen so fast, you can't respond. But then if that's something where you have to address how fast an attack could be if AI can really drive the whole thing, well, then the counter to that is they tell AI to slow down. Well, now you have time to respond and identify. So it's like, I don't know where the rubber meets the road there, but like, those types of things are the things I think about, where when something's machine speed and slamming into, like, say, some external facing thing, you're like, wow, that's a lot of activity, or slamming across your environment really fast with activities that typically are not human speed driven, right? Those are red flags. So like, looking at time windowing of just activity in general sometimes is might be important with this.
Yeah. And if you could, I mean, I'd love to see the ability for security tools to adopt and or detections or
guardrails be built to, you know, try to identify some of those things, right? I mean, machine speed, but there are other indicators of AI type of activity, right? Like you can pick up on some of the prompting styling, you can pick up on some of the language or some of the, you know, kind of things that happen in regards to certain payloads that land. Like it'd be cool to see things evaluated for that, to where you can identify that this is likely, you know, a percentage wise likely that it could be AI use.
Right.
It's coming in from a specific directional way. It's coming after you, right? It's attacking you, basically. And then you can create
ways to segment, like create ways to stop it just by shutting a door so it can't, you know, you can isolate it, basically. Like we have all the technology to do that, you know, and I think there's ways to kind of think about it that way to protect your environment, at least, that we can also start to consider. And it's not, I don't know. I worry too that we're going to have a large wave of everyone trying to identify the AI stuff because it is so flashy, right? But I don't want us to talk about the wrong things. But I think this article really nailed it in, and it got a lot of the meat and the fruits around stuff we kind of should be talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, moving into a little bit more of the traditional article that we talked to. So we have an article from Bitdefender. Famous sparrow targets Azerbaijani oil and gas industry. Bitdefender Labs tracked a multi-wave intrusion campaign targeting an Azerbaijani oil and gas organization between late 2025 and early 2026, and attributed with moderate to high confidence to the China-aligned APT group Famous Sparrow. The operation marks an expansion of Famous Sparrow activity into the Caucasus Energy Infrastructure. I probably brutalized that. I'm sorry. I don't think so.
No. But, yeah. He just says balance because I could say it, so I'll let you run with it.
Well, sorry for the listeners. I should have got myself a little more prepared on that one because I thought it was caucus too, and then I'm looking at the word and I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
So it really has showed the expansion of Famous Sparrow's activity into that energy infrastructure in that region, continuing the broader trend of China Nexus targeting of telecommunications, government, and critical infrastructure sectors. The campaign leveraged repeated exploitation of the same vulnerable Microsoft Exchange server, despite remediation efforts, demonstrating persistence and long-term operational focus. Bitdefender observed deployment of two separate malware families, DDoRat and Turndoor, across multiple intrusion waves, indicating layered tooling and operational redundancy. All of the big red flags that we screen around some of the capabilities of ABT groups, right? We're already seeing the fires off. One of the most notable aspects of the operation was an evolved DLL sideloading technique that gated malware execution behind legitimate application control flow to evade sandbox and behavioral detections. So there's a lot of meat in this one. I'll let you take the first stab and then I'll jump in, Scott.
Yeah, so I thought this was interesting because, you know, they talk about like DLL sideloading and, you know, how it's different. And, you know, what they're referring to is kind of the functionality of how they were able to execute the export functions associated with the DLL and the call. But we've always looked at DLL sideloading as how do attackers set up for it as the biggest trigger point. Regardless of what's in it, what does it do afterwards, all that kind of stuff. And we typically look for, do we see EXEs and DLLs written to the same directory within a small window of time? Because it means files are dropped and they both need to exist, right? And in this case, even though they talk about there's this different way DLLs are being leveraged, and even as they show the evolution of the attack, it's the same thing, right? They're dropping it in a temp folder, but they're still dropping an EXE with the malicious DLL in the same directory right next to it. So I think it's just such a strong indicator. And I remember when DLL sideloading first came out, or, you know, whenever I first heard about it, I guess, because I don't know if those aligned, I was like, man, this is going to be tough. Like, we're used to looking at executables. How do we like monitor DLLs? And it's not about monitoring the DLL. It's really about monitoring how does it get dropped, is the key piece there. So it's good that they can talk about how there's some differences as far as how they're utilizing DLL sideloading, but there's still traditional ways to catch it. So that I liked. Thought it was interesting they're still using proxy, not shell. So that means like there's stuff that hasn't been addressed for that. So, I mean, that happens, right? But that's a pretty big one. And I'm pretty sure that's how they were able to leverage getting domain admin credentials as well. Because if I remember correctly, if that exploit's available and based on how you have, because that's, I think, associated with Exchange, there's ways from that Exchange connectivity to AD to actually then escalate your privileges. So sounds like when they landed in the environment, they were already doing things with domain admin, which one of the things they talked about was RDP sessions, right? RDP sessions with a domain admin account, something worth paying attention to. I mean, any lateral move with a domain admin account, it's kind of a big one. They also talked about trying to get web shells running on public facing infrastructure, right? And yeah, you're looking at the W3WP, which is usually associated with Microsoft ISS worker process. It doing things, it creating files is always a good call out to potential exploitation of web. So, you know, paying attention to some of those things. The file telemetry stuff, obviously, when people are writing the ASPX, it's kind of like an executable piece of code that the web server side can potentially run. So paying attention to those types of things, also, you know, hugely important. They did try to do what looked like a privileged driver activity, right? Launch a service with, I wouldn't call it compromised driver because it looked like they were using a tool specifically, but they were basically going to try to get system privileged access. It didn't work. But they made a good call out in the report talking about, hey, you have a .sys file that's kind of written to a weird directory, which is, you know, associated with drivers. And then you have this service being created that's pointing to, and it's a kernel level, you know, type one, I think, service pointing to this weird path where a driver is. Good indications to look for potentially bad things. Obviously, through the like the change evolution of the malwares and things, there's a lot of change in maybe the encryption they use, the obfuscation, or even the compression, all things that commonly will change just so it makes it harder for things to detect from like a tooling perspective, a EDR, that kind of stuff. So there was some of that activity. I do like they call out what processes that they, you know, are at least coded in that they would inject into. So in this case, it's the search indexer, task engine, internet, iExplorer, task host. Like those are common processes you see on a system. But those processes probably have, at least most of those, no behavior where they're executing things after them, right? They're like they're there for a specific task sometimes. So something that if you're familiar with them, you might be able to see some of those deviations as well. And then there was some PowerShell console being launched manually from what they could tell from their remote desktop stuff they were doing. Obviously, really good to pay attention to when PowerShell is potentially executing things. And obviously, if they're using a domain admin account, then they're obviously going to be running PowerShell as a domain admin, something potentially worth noting. And then the SMB stuff with admin shares. So admin shares are, you know, the $ admin shares that are on machines, a lot of times is disabled by policy, but it's a way actors move files and potentially, you know, laterally move as well. So any kind of call outs where you see $ admin associated with services, tasks, command line arguments, it's worth paying attention to those as well. You might pick up on some of that activity depending on what they're doing specifically and or your telemetry. So those are just some of the key things I kind of picked up on that stood out as these are typical things that I know to hunt for or pay attention to. So yeah, I was curious what you kind of walked away with.
Yeah, a lot of similar things. You know, I do love the article. So the proxy not shell exploits, I'm not surprised that like an Exchange server and public-facing devices that weren't patched or that weren't patched all the way or weren't patched to that place it's not surprising that this exists, although it does, I think, re-echo the point. So we're talking about a China Nexus group, right? We're talking APT level adversary going against well-known vulnerabilities and exploits, like years well-known, right? Like 2021, 2022 well-known. And they're still looking and finding these things. And they're not just looking and finding them in one-off places. They're hitting infrastructure, critical infrastructure with So one, it's like, it's not surprising that the adversary would go after this. It tends to be more surprising that in a critical infrastructure layer, we're not looking for all of this, or at least understanding what we have that's public facing, right? Even as a small piece. Because I know when you say know your environment, a lot of people probably get hives because some environments are very complex. We know, we've worked in some, right? They're not always simple. They're not always an easy door shut, even if you know something's there. Sometimes you have to have acceptable risk in things, but there are other things you can do. So it was interesting to see that, but not for the way that I think most would see, because it's just echoing, hey, big APT group, a lot of resources, looking at 5-6-year-old exploits, right? Leveraging them and leveraging them effectively. The other thing that I seen too is, you know, there was a lot of common stuff, and this is something we echo all the time. So a lot of the common stuff that falls into, you touched on the RDP sessions internal. They talked about the use of variant impact at tooling like SMB exec, PS exec, AT exec. These are identifiable in telemetry pretty easy. It was interesting to me that when I read this, like looking between the lines, not to go too far into the weeds, but they did talk about that .sys file and how their security tools kind of blocked that side loading attempt.
Yeah.
But then the MPacket tooling was able to effectively run it. I'm generally curious what the security tooling is that would detect the side loading, but not basic MPacket usage. But yeah, and then, you know, the other part kind of from this is, I'm curious what you think, Scott. We see it a lot. We see it leveraged. I mean, this isn't net new or news, but have you ever stopped and thought about, beyond the behaviors, like what are other ways, maybe more abstract ways, that we could consider as hunters to identify when an adversary's payload is leveraging or heavily leveraging those like Windows API hooks? Like, are there things that you've come across or things that you can think about in that way? And I know I'm kind of blindsiding you with that question a little bit, but I think it's a cool conversation that I haven't really heard people talk about. So I'm just curious.
So yeah, the API hook thing is always been kind of a bane because I've wanted to just have that telemetry, but I know it's a lot of telemetry because, I mean, obviously the system itself is just, you know, using APIs to do everything. But a lot of things aren't necessarily hooked to get those APIs. There's some tools that can see into it a little bit, and sometimes tools do see into it and they just alert on certain activity, but they don't expose the telemetry as well. But from my experience and some things I've looked at, when certain APIs are leveraged, there's still a core system process that is then like potentially running. And I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly, so this might not be an accurate statement, but like, for instance, when you want to create a process and you use an API to do it versus, you know, whatever the chain is to create that process, there's a chance it'll come off of like SVC host or something is now the parent of this process that got spawned that way, right? So like it kind of like disconnects from whatever the thing was because it's using APIs in a different way to then spawn something. So there's kind of stuff like that that's kind of like, well, that's kind of a random connection there. Especially when you look at stuff like SVC host, is it executing things that aren't in system directories versus like in weird directories, stuff like that. As a kind of example, I mean, we're still kind of talking behaviors, but you're kind of talking behaviors around API uses in general. It's just something that I feel like it's hard to test because it takes so much development, at least in my mind, because I don't know how to just like natively say, let me write this code real quick that's going to pull all these APIs and see what it does. It is kind of a blind spot. And then I always talk about authors that use APIs for like malware and things have a much more of an upper hand to some degree, right? For certain activities. Mm-hmm. So it's something that people should be aware of. But it's a nut that I haven't fully cracked yet. It's kind of like still kind of floating around with like, you know, abstract ideas and things that I probably want to test before I really speak too much more on them. But yeah.
Yeah. It's a fun pull. I feel like it's a pull that's untouched, and I'm honestly looking forward to diving into it more. Cause I feel like there's a lot of stuff there that we could benefit from understanding or creating things. And then yeah, last, like just to kind of go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say like from like malware analysis, like, you know, what API calls in succession, right? Of flag something bad, like how something injects into memory is like the most common, right? You create a sleeping process, you allocate memory, and then you shove something into it. Like we know from an API perspective what is not good, or when something's decrypting or encrypting things, like we can identify that. It's just that telemetry isn't like widely exposed in a lot of things. So,
right. And kind of closing off from that article, as we kind of round out the show, I love articles that call this out because this is the space we live in, where it specifically says, hey, consider applying runtime behavioral monitoring. Signature-based detections will not or don't always catch fileless execution, sideloading, loaders that gate their execution on hosts. Detection must watch for behavior, not binary signatures. I love that takeaway. So,
yeah, it's a good call. All right. Well, I think that kind of wraps up. We had a lot. We kind of talked about, so hopefully people walked away with something. But I really want to thank everyone for joining Out of the Woods Through Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to sticking back up next time. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of May 11th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.